SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. If you or someone that you know actually suffers from SIBO, then you know it can be hell to try to wrangle this inflammation, to basically try to find things that work for you to gain control of how you feel. I'm Eric Rieger, host of the Gut Check Project, joined by my partner, board-certified gastroenterologist Ken Brown. Ken, is SIBO an issue in your practice?
So SIBO is such a big deal because so many people are misdiagnosed. I, as a gastroenterologist, see a lot of people, so many people for second opinions, and ultimately I end up diagnosing them with small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. They've been told that it is in their head. They've been put on antidepressants. They have been labeled as having irritable bowel syndrome or functional bowel disease. And then looking back on the history of it, it really is small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, SIBO. A lot of this is being missed. So what I wanted to do today in lieu of our standard podcast is I've actually put a presentation together to talk about SIBO itself, the pathophysiology, meaning what's really going on in your gut and what's happening. And because of all the thousands of people that I have treated, I realize that we need to hit SIBO from different angles. And I've put together this combination, and I'm going to explain exactly why we have different ways to try and treat it, and why so many people that have tried different things still have symptoms. So this is a public service announcement with a presentation, sort of a podcasty presentation type thing. And
A prezicast.
a prezicast. This is a prezicast. So if you have any digestive issues, suffer from bloating or anything, I strongly suggest that you just hang around and watch this presentation. Love to get your feedback and find out more what you've tried. Hit us up, let us know. But I think that we can just jump right into the presentation.
Let's do that
All right.
because I think it's kind of interesting that you brought up that you want to attack it from different angles, honestly, Ken, because I think that a lot of times people move and they think that they need to find that one solution. And what we've seen through the clinic, what we've seen through the patients who come through, is that they are challenged because they have to keep finding new things to do something and they keep hopping. So let's
Yeah, I'm going to explain why a lot of things are happening when you have SIBO. And the most important thing is it's not just a nuisance. What you're going to learn is that this can actually be something that can lead to very serious chronic
Oh,
diseases.
yeah, for sure.
So I'm going to share my screen here.
Sharing of the screen.
Sharing of the screen.
All right, I think that's up there. There we go. I think we're good.
I think we're good. So, what I've labeled this is as SIBO support. What else can be done? And first of all, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to go ahead and look at this. And I really appreciate any feedback that you might give us about this. What we're going to be talking about is all these people that are suffering from SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, just like Eric said. What can we actually do to help them? And as he mentioned, my name is Ken Brown. I'm a board-certified gastroenterologist. Now, I have been dealing in this space since 2012. And what I mean by in this space is prior to that, we were just labeling everybody as having irritable bowel syndrome. I was actually a principal investigator in doing research with Dr. Mark Pimentel way back then when he was the initial person to realize that the problem is not just being labeled as irritable bowel, but it could be due to bacteria growing where it shouldn't be, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. So since then, I've really become more of a functional gastroenterologist and tried to view things from a natural perspective. And because of this, I do end up getting a lot of second opinions and I treat some of the toughest people. So, what does my typical second opinion look like? Well, it's usually a very frustrated person that has had years of bloating, abdominal pain, bowel issues, diarrhea, or constipation. Now, they also have multiple food intolerances. So, a lot of these people come to me and they say, I can't eat this, 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 and this, causes all kinds of issues. Brain fog is really common. Fatigue is really common, and even trouble sleeping. Often, there is a new diagnosis of an autoimmune problem, and that could be thyroid, that could be celiac, that could be Crohn's or ulcerative colitis. But there's this pattern to this that we're seeing all these symptoms go on. And this person is usually just labeled as having irritable bowel syndrome, IBS. IBS is so common. What exactly is IBS? Well, I consider IBS a trash can term. IBS affects up to 20% of the US population. And the symptoms are abdominal pain, change in bowel habits, that the pain goes away if you have a bowel movement, and lasting more than 3 months. Here's the kicker. The most common symptom in everyone that has IBS is bloating, and it's not even used in the diagnostic criteria.
That just does not make any sense.
It's never made any sense to me. And something you and I have talked about, how in the world, when you have a disease, oh, you have diarrhea, you're going to be labeled as IBS.
Mm-hmm.
I have constipation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be labeled the same diagnosis.
No, that's weird because we're having two different symptoms.
Two totally different symptoms. And so that's the interesting thing. That's why you find so many people labeled as having irritable bowel. So what ends up happening is somebody goes to the doctor and they say, oh, I have all these issues. My gut hurts. I have diarrhea. I have constipation. And then the doctor does an endoscopy, does a colonoscopy, does some blood work, pats you on the head and says, good news, Eric, it's just IBS. The problem is that that patient then still leaves the office. They're frustrated. They are still bloated. They still have constipation or diarrhea, and they still have the brain fog. So they've been told by many people not to worry about anything. It's just IBS. And we see this all the time.
So I'd say that oftentimes when we have the patients that come through, whenever we're getting ready to scope someone, it's one of literally the biggest complaints. If they are there to see you and they've already seen someone else, they feel like they've been dismissed. They feel as if I went to another professional. I told them about these, what I consider serious everyday symptoms. And literally they're almost telling me as if I'm imagining this problem and that it should just be good news. The symptoms that I'm suffering from really, quote, aren't that big of a deal. And clearly to these patients, it's a big deal. They deal with this every day.
That's a really good point. So just because you've been labeled with a diagnosis doesn't necessarily mean that you're completely out of the woods. Even if your doctor says, don't worry, it's just IBS, because we now know more about this. In fact, the bloating and the symptoms of IBS are actually the canary in the coal mine. And what I mean by that is now we're realizing that a lot of chronic degenerative diseases like dementia, like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, cancer, autoimmune diseases, all health begins and ends in the gut. And they begin with bloating, because bloating is the canary in the coal mine saying that something isn't right. So it isn't like we should just sit there and go, good news, it's IBS, you're fine. I disagree with that. I say this is the warning sign that we really have to buckle down now and figure out what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, it's I would say it's comparable to whenever someone says, good news, the air pressure detector on your car says that the air pressure is low. Okay, well, it could just be that the air pressure is low and you need a little bit more, but maybe there's a nail in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly while you're driving down, you lose a tire. Well, that's a big deal.
Yeah,
so you want to pay attention.
The sad part is that bloating has become so common that people just consider it normal now because of the standard American diet, because of all these other issues.
Oh,
it's
my gosh.
Become that common, and we need to change that. And all of this concept of bacterial overgrowth is really interesting because it comes down to bacteria. Now, you're going to remember this. A lot of people already know about small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, but this is a fairly new concept. Like I said, it's 12 years ago that we got published in the New England Journal of Medicine discussing the treatment of this for diarrhea. But this is very similar to what happened back in 1982 when it was felt that ulcers were due to stress and depression. And it was then that it was discovered that actually it's a bacteria called H. pylori, which is causing ulcers. This is very similar to this huge paradigm shift that has taken place with irritable bowel. When I was training, if somebody was labeled as irritable bowel, the next step was to give them an antidepressant.
Makes no sense.
And the irony of it is now we know that antidepressants affect the gut adversely. It affects the microbiome adversely. It actually, you and I have done whole talks on the amount of serotonin produced in the gut and how it affects it. So this is nothing short of a complete paradigm shift that we have to break the cycle of saying it's just IBS. This is due to bacteria. In other words, IBS is SIBO. This is how we have to start thinking about it.
They would definitely.
And you know, I've had questions asked, journalists have called and things like that. And they're like, what is the incidence of SIBO? And the problem is we don't really know, because the definition, prior definition of SIBO was you needed a breath test or a culture or something. I can diagnose and treat most of it from a history where somebody gives me this history of what's going on. And so IBS is SIBO. So if you've ever been labeled with this, this is what's actually going on. It's really not that complex. SIBO is when bacteria are growing where they shouldn't be, which is in the small bowel. The small bowel should be relatively sterile, and you actually have your microbiome, which is the 100 trillion bacteria living in your colon. That's where most of your bacteria should be. So if you go through a real stressful situation, if you have an infection, if you take antibiotics, or if there's a really poor diet that results in poor motility, then bacteria can actually start to grow where they shouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
Small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. It's not that the bacteria are good or bad. It's that they're actually growing where they shouldn't be. And then what ends up happening is you eat and the bacteria break down the food before you can.
You know, you mentioned something about people use breath testing as far as the previous diagnostic criteria to figure out if something was SIBO. And a long time ago, we had this discussion about how you're having success making people literally feel better by going by their symptoms. And there's nothing wrong, I would imagine, with utilizing a test, but people shouldn't ever forget, why did they begin to test in the first place? Don't let a test dictate your happiness. If you're finally finding success in your symptoms, then you probably wouldn't have continued to use that test. So in other words, just don't use only a test to chase for your happiness.
Yeah, totally. So I do use breath tests often. I use them in certain situations, but I don't ever hang my hat on any one test. It's like hanging your hat on any one blood test. That's the problem.
Yep.
Is that if we're not thinking about this, you get normal blood work, normal scopes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Eric, you're normal. It's in your head. I'm going to give you an antidepressant.
You get dismissed.
You get dismissed. So you now have bacteria growing in your small bowel. You eat, specifically carbohydrates. The bacteria break down that food before you can digest it, and they start producing gas. The primary gas that's released is hydrogen. And then depending on the type of bacteria that you have, there's two major gases that cause symptoms. The first one is methane. So when you eat, the bacteria break down the food, hydrogen is produced. And if you have a special, it's an archaeobacter, it's not even a bacteria, but for this purposes, a special organism called an archaeobacter, it is known as a methanogen, meaning it's what it loves to do is take hydrogen and make methane. And when methane is produced, what it does is it slows everything down. By slowing everything down, more bacteria can grow, more gas is produced. Now we have more slowing, and now this is how we can label somebody as having irritable bowel with constipation. This explains the bloated, constipated person.
Yeah.
And this is what my original research was actually on, looking at this person, because we don't have any pharmaceuticals to treat this person.
Yeah, it's kind of wild. And that's actually a discussion you referenced Pimentel earlier. That's a discussion that y'all had back when y'all were doing some clinical research together.
Yeah, exactly. So we were looking at a drug called Xifaxan, which I'm going to show you what we actually got the FDA, or what the company got the FDA approval for. I was just a principal investigator on it. But that's when we were discussing that there's really nothing available to help the bloated, constipated person. This is actually how I developed our product Atrantil, because it has polyphenols that get rid of the organism that makes methane.
Oh, I'm sorry. So the methane clearly is going to cause slowing down, methane-related constipation, and then lead to more inflammation because it's allowing bacteria to basically proliferate where they shouldn't be.
Exactly. So then the question is, well, what about diarrhea? You said that you can have irritable bowel with diarrhea. Now, this is really interesting because just recently they've developed a technology to do a breath test to check for this. And the person with diarrhea is producing hydrogen sulfide. As it turns out, there are tons of different types of bacteria that actually love producing hydrogen sulfide. There's a whole genus of bacteria. They're called sulfide reducers, and they'll make hydrogen sulfide. Hydrogen sulfide basically works like a stimulus. And so when that is produced, it creates your colon to actually contract and move.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't really affect the motility of the intestine, of the small intestine. So the bacteria continue to grow. But when that gas is produced, it hits the colon and now you have diarrhea. So now we have this bloated diarrhea concept,
mm-hmm.
which is the symptoms. But what I really want to talk about, way more than just the gas that's being produced, is for everyone to understand that SIBO causes inflammation. All health begins and ends in the gut. And when you have SIBO, this bacteria is not a benign process. It's not just IBS or SIBO. This overgrowth is not normal and it's not welcome. And the body definitely reacts to it. It ultimately causes inflammation. This is why the bloating is the canary in the coal mine. This is why I say when somebody comes in and they tell me this, I think of this picture and I think of bacteria turning on the immune system, creating a cascade of inflammation.
Well, there is no compartment within our bodies that is just solely exists by itself and doesn't affect something else. A prime example, someone hurts their back, it ruins their day. It'll move around well. They have a headache. They don't want to do things that they normally would do in work. If you have a crick in your neck, you have a difficult time carrying on, even though the rest of your body technically isn't injured, it affects you. The same thing applies here to the gut. Once inflammation gets going, it more than likely is wreaking havoc in other parts of your body. So it's just something to keep in mind.
Well put. How does it do that? So SIBO causes this inflammation. Now, this is a little bit of a busy slide, but bear with me here, because what's happening is in your small intestine, you have these tight junctions. It is very complex because the body has to figure out what it needs and what it needs to keep out. When you have SIBO, or if you're exposing the intestines to a lot of allergens or things that your body doesn't like, your body samples it, brings it across this tight junction, and then these cells make this decision. Do I need to mount an inflammatory response, or do I just chill out? So if I reach up and, oh, it's food, don't worry about it, we're going to absorb this and eat it. But if I reach up, and it is a piece of a bacteria called a lipopolysaccharide, or I reach up and it happens to be other allergens, maybe something that has a lot of histamine in it,
mm-hmm.
then what ends up happening is you have leaky gut, or you get more exposure to what's going on. So when you have SIBO, you have this chronic loop. And the first cell that actually gets exposed to these things are what's called a mast cell. This is important because the mast cell then sends signals to other cells,
mm-hmm.
but one of the things it produces is histamine. And when it produces histamine, that histamine is like a domino effect. And that histamine will then set off other inflammatory cytokines. Histamine is super important when you get hurt, you need this kind of thing. And then what ends up happening also is that it actually is able to communicate directly with the central nervous system. So this complex slide, what it's showing is when you have SIBO, you're constantly creating this exposure. This exposure constantly is telling the mast cell to release histamine, and it's constantly turning on other cells to produce inflammatory cytokines while it's telling your brain something's wrong. So now let's go back to the original person, brain fog, fatigue, all that stuff. It's due to inflammation.
Not only that, from anesthesia and anesthesia training, something that we learned about histamine is that an overabundance of histamine activity leads to agitation, also leads to elements of insomnia or difficulty remaining asleep, because effectively, histamine is a call to action. Histamine is part of the waking cycle that we have. Whenever we wake up in the morning, you've got the cortisol increase for somebody who's normally healthy. It happens in the morning. The same with histamine. It's a part of waking you up. So if you chronically have inflammation and histamine circulating throughout your body, you might have an issue of agitation. You might have an issue of lack of patience. You may have an issue of, I'm not getting enough sleep, or I'm having a difficult time falling asleep. It simply could be related to a chronic inflammatory issue in your bowel like SIBO.
Absolutely. So the histamine is such a big deal that the body has ways to try and control it. And one of the ways that it does this is through an enzyme called diamine oxidase. So in your intestinal lining, this is a 3D model of a diamine oxidase enzyme.
Mm-hmm.
What it does is its job is to control the level of histamine that is being ingested and or produced.
Mm-hmm.
So if the mast cells are producing too much histamine, diamine oxidase is there to go, slow down, cowboy. You know, let's do this. But when you have SIBO, bacteria actually can produce their own histamine. So you've got increased histamine going on from the bacteria, and these enzymes need to control all of this histamine that's going on. Here's the problem. When you have all these bacteria that are in the intestinal lining, inflammation actually damages the cells that make this enzyme. So you have the bacteria, and the inflammatory cascade damages the cells or the factories that produce this enzyme. So you have less of the diamine oxidase. The inflammation that's going on makes the diamine oxidase not work as well.
Mm-hmm.
This low DAO results in our digestive enzymes not working well. So the inflammation and the histamine don't allow the pancreatic enzymes to break the food down as well. And then you've got this bacteria producing histamine. So when you have SIBO, we've got really high levels of histamine floating around.
Yeah, and that's critically important to understand. Why is it that histamine is becoming an issue? And the body is, when optimized, is in perfect balance. If there's one thing, process that starts, there's always a way to stop it. And effectively, what I think that you've shown here is this yin and yang association between histamine and diamine oxidase. You remove diamine oxidase, histamine kind of runs rampant all over the body, causes all kinds of problems.
Exactly. So what does this actually do? Elevated histamine actually has systemic effects. You were just talking about it from an anesthesia perspective. Histamine is essential, first of all. It is what's called a bioactive amine. This is a signaling molecule that's important for many, many functions. It's generated in the body to a response to allergens, injuries, foreign substances, and even alcohol. Now, since it's released by the immune system, it can go throughout the entire body. So if you're producing too much histamine, you can actually regulate the sleep-wake cycle. It can affect your cognitive function, your inflammatory response. And there's many different types of histamine receptors, and they're found in all these organs: brain, lung, heart, gut, all of these things. So when you have high histamine levels, it can actually affect you systemically. And this is something that we call histamine intolerance. And these are people that will show up with all different kinds of issues after they eat. They'll have headaches, migraines, nasal congestion, fatigue. They might have hives, digestive issues, anxiety, insomnia, all of that.
Mm-hmm.
When this continues for a long period of time, you end up getting mast cell activation syndrome,
mm-hmm.
where your mast cells are so, or the histamine is so uncontrolled that these mast cells produce any amount of histamine and you have a full body reaction to it.
Yeah, well, you've even described in the past about how someone suddenly can have a new reaction to a food that they once used to tolerate. And it's because whenever we eat, our body reacts to the food that we eat, and in order to make certain that we don't get sick. I mean, because that's what our digestive system does. If we don't have a good balance of histamine and diamine oxidase, well, then the issue is this reaction to just eating what was normally food before becomes a big situation where now the person found a new food that they simply can't tolerate. And it could be because they've got SIBO and they aren't producing enough of their own diamine oxidase.
Yeah, totally. So the concept of histamine is pretty complex, but we've got this mechanism to try and control it. Now, the problem is, we said that when you have inflammation, that mechanism gets hindered a little bit. So what could be the start of the full inflammatory process? And we now know what it is. It's basically the shell of the bacteria. It's called a lipopolysaccharide. Even if your body is fighting the SIBO, So even if you have bacteria, when your body does this, lipopolysaccharides are left. So the bacteria will die and they leave their shell. Think of it like rubble. Think of it like a war-torn street where you just have all this rubble that's there. All that rubble still can cause an inflammatory response. Mm-hmm. So you can see that the SIBO can lead to increased inflammation just from the lipopolysaccharide. So they leave behind these reactive things called LPS. This LPS causes that leaky gut. This gets into the bloodstream and triggers the systemic inflammation. And we now know that LPS causing the inflammation has been associated with liver disease and heart disease, and it can cross the blood-brain barrier. Now we have that model that I talked about before. This is probably the reason for dementia and things.
That's too bad.
So the LPS is the first thing that's actually creating the inflammatory response. The histamine goes down. Now we've got unchecked inflammatory response. Something else also happens in people with SIBO that really doesn't get talked about a whole lot. And a very crucial mineral is lost to SIBO, and it's magnesium. It is essential. Magnesium is an essential mineral, and it's been estimated that 40% of all people have a magnesium deficiency just based on diet and lifestyle and things. But if you have SIBO, you're at tremendous risk for having an intracellular magnesium deficiency. So why does this matter? Because magnesium is used everywhere in the body. It is crucial for gut health. It is a key nutrient for gut motility, and it's used as a cofactor in making digestive enzymes. Magnesium in itself has direct anti-inflammatory properties.
Mm-hmm.
So one other issue is that when you have bacteria growing, this inflammation actually causes poor magnesium absorption. The bacteria use the magnesium. This is like insult to injury. You're carrying around these unwanted intruders, and they're like, oh, well, I'm going to eat this magnesium instead of you.
Break into your house and wear your clothes.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And we now know that the low magnesium causes poor intestinal motility. This is known as the migrating motor complex. If you are seasoned in the world of SIBO, you know that this is one of the things that we have to treat, is the migrating motor complex. And the systemic inflammation alters magnesium storage in all your vital organs. So it's super, super important. Now, those are three concepts that are rarely talked about when we're talking about SIBO. Most of the time, people are just saying, well, let's just treat SIBO. So what we currently have is antibiotics. Now, antibiotics like Xifaxan, like neomycin, different antibiotics. There are natural solutions. I'm going to do a little Atrantil plug right here. But there are natural polyphenols, which can help in this situation. We do use promotility agents. I was just talking about the migrating motor complex. And of course, a lot of people are put on very restrictive diets. The problem with the restricted diets like FODMAP, SCD, Elemental, is that they all may have lower levels of magnesium than you actually need. Now, where can we improve? So what I talk about the SIBO support is we need to stop the inflammation. We need to control the histamine levels. We need to get rid of the lipopolysaccharide, the LPS, and we have to restore the magnesium levels. So you and I have worked for the last couple of years pretty hard on this, and this is why we've come up with the SIBO support box. Very excited to share this with our community. Over the past year, we've treated well over, I think we're getting close to 1,000 people now.
Yeah.
With incredible results, people that have failed other things, and now it makes more sense why. So this is sort of an exclusive offer for our community if you're willing to go through this presentation and understand why. What the SIBO box consists of is it's pre-portioned packets, AM and PM packets. We have teamed up with Zymogen, which offers physician-exclusive products that have gone through rigorous testing, and they're made in a facility which is registered for pharmaceutical prescriptions. This means that each box is made for each individual. I bring this up because, of note, by law, when you're manufacturing in a pharmaceutical grade facility, they have to print on their best use in 60 days. That's not the case here. These actually have a shelf life of 3 years, but it will say best used in 60 days. That's because we did not want to have these manufactured in any other place except for some place that was actually FDA registered to do prescriptions as well.
It's literally packed in a pharmacy owned by Zymogen.
Yeah. So then what ends up happening, this box gets shipped to you and you just open the AM packet and you take what's in there. You take the PM packet. It's a 30-day supply. And once again, by law, they have to stamp best used in 60 days. Just rest assured, this is good for over a couple of years. So now let's look at what's actually inside of it. Well, in the AM and PM packet, you're going to see Atrantil. Now, Atrantil is the product that I developed initially for this particular problem, and we have had tremendous success. We've been on the market now. We've treated over,
over a million now.
Yeah, it's well over a million people. Atrantil is specifically formulated using large, stable polyphenols. Polyphenols are the molecules that make vegetables and fruits colorful. Mm-hmm. It's actually what makes the Mediterranean diet healthy for you. These polyphenols are the anti-aging, anti-inflammatory molecules. But Atrantil is unique because it uses some of the most largest and stable polyphenols, specifically Quebracho Colorado. The combination of Quebracho Colorado, horse chestnut, and peppermint work together. Basically, those three ingredients come in. The peppermint is used to slow down the spasms in that particular area to allow the Quebracho and the chestnut to work better. The Quebracho has natural anti-defense against the Archaebacter, and it can soak up the hydrogen, essentially starving it. And the horse chestnut also can block the enzyme producing the methane. Now, the beauty is both peppermint and horse chestnut are used for a bunch of other things. Horse chestnut's been used for varicose veins and hemorrhoids. Peppermint's used in all different kinds of gut protective things. But it's the unique combination of those three, mm-hmm. which is what makes Atrantil so different and so special, which is why it is the only patented polyphenol blend that has been shown in clinical trials to help 4 out of 5 people with bloating and gut issues like that.
And not to gloss over, but it was recently studied at the Feinberg School of Medicine just 1.5 years ago, where they concluded, independent from Atrantil, that yes, this is the only solution that works in this manner.
Yes. So what do these polyphenols do? These particular polyphenols, it's a busy slide, but basically it decreases all of the inflammatory pathways. So it decreases methane, harmful bacteria, NF-kappa beta, TNF-alpha. It decreases hydrogen sulfide while it increases antioxidants, increases the anti-aging pathways like the sirtuin-1 pathway and the NRF2 pathway, and it produces short-chain fatty acids. We've got multiple studies showing that that particular combination increases things like butyrate significantly more than even just fiber. Mm-hmm. And it's been shown to increase helpful bacteria like Akkermansia mucinophila. And it improves microbial diversity. So your microbiome is also fed. So in other words, Atrantil is natural. It works in the small bowel and the colon. It eliminates methane and hydrogen, and it improves the microbiome. So in the AM packet, we have diamine oxidase, DAO. That's that enzyme that we were talking about. So essentially what it's doing is it's replenishing the natural enzyme deficiency. It neutralizes histamine produced by the bacteria, and it neutralizes the histamine in foods. What people don't realize is that alcohol, fermented foods, avocados, spinach, cheese, all have a really high histamine level. Mm-hmm. So when you're eating that, if you don't have the enzyme to break it down, then this is where a lot of these people think they have food intolerances, just like you were talking about, mm-hmm. because you're introducing more histamine. Now, what's really special about this diamine oxidase, we looked at a bunch of different ones. You can go on Amazon and see some for, it is very difficult to actually get a high quality diamine oxidase. Mm-hmm. And Zymogen was able to actually source this from Europe. And what it does is it's able to be stable in the digestive tract. So if you think about it, that 3D model is sitting in the digestive tract. Any histamine that's coming by works like a magnet. It soaks it up and neutralizes it. So this has been formulated to actually resist being broken down in this whole process. It's going to bind to it. And without this enzyme, all the histamine that you eat will never get processed and just gets absorbed and creates this inflammatory cascade.
What I find interesting about using DAO versus diamine oxidase versus, let's just say, another quote unquote solution for histamine like Benadryl. Benadryl is indiscriminate. Your body cannot control the way that Benadryl or things similar to that are distributed and used to combat histamine. That's why oftentimes when people are given diphenhydramine, they just simply get really sleepy and tired. And then once it wears off, well, they're back to the inflammatory state. Supplementing the enzyme with DAO actually allows the body to control the way that your body wishes to control histamine. It's a far more natural yin and yang existence.
Absolutely.
Between the relationship between you and histamine.
Absolutely. Well put. So next, what do we do about all that debris and lipopolysaccharide that we were talking about? In the AM and PM packet, there's something called immunoglobulin IgY. IgY is an immunoglobulin. If you've ever heard of anything like colostrum, that's why people take colostrum, is because it actually has something called IgG in it. And what these antibodies do, these immunoglobulins are called antibodies, immunoglobulins, they actually bind to allergens, bacteria, viruses, and toxins. Now, this is egg-derived IgY because the IgG is actually been shown to be destroyed in the digestive process. So when we were looking at this, clinical studies have shown that the IgY does not get broken down. So that means it can go through the whole small bowel and it can bind to all these other things. It is derived from avium egg. So in theory, if you've got a severe egg allergy, you might want to discuss it with your doctor first, because technically you might have a cross reaction, but I've never seen that actually happen. People having a true egg allergy to the yolk is where that is. But the key here is that the stability of it goes through the whole small bowel. Mm-hmm. And so what that means is that it's, think of it like a bulldozer or just going through your small bowel, picking up all this debris and lipopolysaccharide. It's like a construction site cleanup crew, and it goes all the way through. And so what it does is it's going to bind to the lipopolysaccharides. It's going to bind to the bacteria. It's going to bind to the viruses and even fungus, allergens, and toxins. So this is really, really important to stop the inflammatory cascade as it's going through. So we've figured out the histamine issue. We've figured out the lipopolysaccharide issue. Now let's, oh, that's right. And of course, it, by doing all this, you're going to heal leaky gut.
Sure.
All of this heals the leaky gut aspect. Now let's look at the highly absorbable magnesium blend in the evening packet. In the evening packet, we have a proprietary combination of magnesium glycinate and magnesium malate. Magnesium glycinate has been shown to improve sleep quality, decrease anxiety, improves nerve transmission, and mood regulation. Magnesium malate improves muscle function, the motility. It reduces inflammation and enhanced cellular energy production, and it's been shown to increase bone density as well. There's many magnesiums out there. We chose these two specifically for the decreased anxiety, the improved sleep, and the improved muscle function, the motility, because of that migrating motor complex. So this magnesium, by making sure that the magnesium is replenished, what we're doing is we're increasing intestinal peristalsis, the migrating motor complex. We're going to increase digestive enzyme production because it's used as a cofactor for making digestive enzymes so that you can digest your food better. And ultimately, it's going to work directly and decrease the inflammatory process itself. Hence, the SIBO support box, science-based, doctor-developed, and patient-proven. We are seeing tremendous success with this. And ultimately, what this box does is gets rid of the intestinal bacteria, Atrantil. It improves the microbiome health, Atrantil. It decreases inflammation, combination of all of them, decreases high histamine levels, diamine oxidase, removes LPS, IgY, and it replenishes the magnesium, which improves motility, increases digestive enzymes. So that is where we would take some questions here. And I encourage everyone that if you came through this, please ask any questions, send it to us. We're on Instagram at Gut Check Project. Where else?
You can go to gutcheckproject.com to access our other shows. You can also, if you're watching this on Rumble or on YouTube or really anything that has show notes, look in the show notes and we've got a direct link for you to learn simply more about the SIBO support box. Not to gloss over it real quick, but we did hit on magnesium rather quickly. Many people talk about they take magnesium supplements. Could you kind of hit on why you specifically chose glycinate and malate over something that is far less expensive to acquire like citrate or citrate?
Absolutely. So there's different types of magnesiums. It can be very confusing. Here's the really simple thing. If it says oxide or citrate, it's usually the cheaper version and it's very poorly absorbed. That means that it can be used to help go to the bathroom because it works like a laxative.
Yeah.
But it's not being absorbed where we need it. So we need highly absorbable forms. The glycinate has been shown to help with anxiety, and it's very absorbable. Mm-hmm. And that malate has been shown to improve muscle function. There are other forms of magnesium which are also highly absorbable, like 3-8, and I'm missing one. There's another one. But the highly absorbable ones that most people know about are 3-8, malate, and glycinate.
Mm-hmm.
There's one more. I can't remember which one it is. But the 3-8 is good to help sleep, but I like the glycinate for the anxiety and the malate for the muscle contraction. But definitely, if you're on oxide or citrate, it's poorly absorbed.
Well, you can almost look at any supplement, even if it's a combo enzyme or vitamin, and it'll say that it has magnesium on the inside. And if you break it down on the ingredients list, you'll almost always find mag citrate or mag citrate, however you wish to say it. But that's what they're using. It's just like Ken said, it's inexpensive. And technically, they're giving you magnesium, but more than likely, you're just not absorbing a significant amount of magnesium whatsoever. So you're not really gaining anything. You're certainly not getting cell wall stability from taking it.
Yeah. And as long as we're on that topic, because I do have patients ask this, and this is something that we do get a whole lot. Why would I go on Amazon and I'll find what somebody says is histamine support?
Oh, sure.
And it's $8.
Yeah.
Versus a very high quality diamine oxidase, like the one that Zymogen is importing from Europe. And it just comes down to that. To make something that's actually going to stay viable in the gut, then you need, it's difficult to make it. It's difficult to keep it at a very high level that's actually going to work. There are other histamine support things. And if you read the labels, most of them involve some version of other polyphenols like quercetin,
mm-hmm.
where they say, oh, well, this has been shown to stabilize. And a lot of that is an extrapolation of the anti-inflammatory effects of the polyphenols. But there's a reason why putting this box together was difficult to find these exact things. We worked very closely with the scientists at Zymogen to help us procure some of the best products that have certificate of analysis and all these things. So we know that what we're doing is giving the highest quality product made at a facility that is actually registered to do drugs. And we're doing supplements there because we're seeing that these things can affect people. We don't always have to rely on drugs. Mother Nature knows what is going on. Just like you talked about the diamine oxidase versus Benadryl.
Yeah, 100%. And knowing how to measure the quality of an ingredient for a solution is a big deal. We talked about magnesium. You just hit on diamine oxidase. I mean, many people may look at something and say, well, it has so many milligrams or micrograms, but that's really not what you need to look at. You need to look at the HDU, the histamine, degrading units, and how well that holds up when it gets to the site of action.
Mm-hmm.
And without knowing all these different levels, this is the amount of time that the researchers and the scientists that we use, not only at Zymogen, but even a few who are international, who weighed in on our polyphenol attack and how that actually worked for acromantia, mesenophila, et cetera, and butyrate production. It's a lot of effort to put together this comprehensive solution in a SIBO support box so that people who are suffering don't have to keep spinning their wheels. So anyhow, Ken, anything else to add?
No, we're good. So
be sure and check in the show notes or flip notes, wherever you happen to, whatever platform you have to be using to find more information. We will provide a link so that you can shoot straight to it. Otherwise, just like Ken said, go to at Gut Check Project on Instagram. Shoot us any questions that you may have and check out gutcheckproject.com for other episodes.
Excellent. Take care.
See y'all.